on Health and Human Services session this morning, and we're going to... before I open a work session or a public hearing on House Bill 3529, I'm going to make an announcement. Due to the fact that we're going to be closing this committee down after Friday, which isn't a scheduled day for us, I have a potential schedule for 8:30 Friday morning in case we have bills that cannot get done today and tomorrow. I have gone ahead and taken the liberty to publish most of the bills that we're working on today on tomorrow's agenda simply because I don't have time to put them on the agenda for tomorrow if I can't get them done today. So if we finish a bill today, you can mentally erase it from tomorrow's agenda. And by the end of the day, when we see what we do, I will probably schedule everything for a potential Friday meeting that's due on Wednesday, just in case we don't get through with them on our Thursday, because I have to do it 24 hours ahead. We're not in imminent
danger
of signy die. So I'm trying to do that. I realize it's a little inconvenient for some of you that might have to travel a little distance to get here, but we'll do the best we can to turn these things out today. And yes, Senator Dunn.
I hope we can, Mr. I'm chairing the meeting at 8:30 on Friday morning.
Yes,
so I hope we do.
I don't want to have to stop you from your chair duties to come over here and vote.
Yeah,
I hope not. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3529 and Representative Minnis, for you, and do you have others with you that you wish to bring? Okay. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Karen Minnis, State Representative from District 20. House Bill 3529 is a very straightforward bill. It has to deal with a woman that goes to see her gynecologist who may find a problem when she goes to that initial visit. Some insurance company in the past have required her to go back to her primary care physician before she can do follow-up visits with her gynecologist. What this bill does will allow her to go back to the gynecologist on repeat visits without having to go back to her primary care physician. John Powell worked with us on this bill, and it received unanimous support. So very simple, straightforward. This allows women to get follow-up treatment without having to go back to the primary care physician.
Well, thank you so much for coming and introducing this. I'm ready to go into work session if my committee doesn't object. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3529A and go into a work session on House Bill 3529A.
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 3529A to the floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Further discussion or objections? Hearing none, we'll first call the roll. Senator Steele, would you consider carrying the
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Castillo has consented to carry House Bill 3529A. So I'll take the work session on House Bill 3529A and a couple other announcements. Senate Bill 684 will not be dealt with today or tomorrow or Friday. And House Bill 2108A will be put off until tomorrow. I'm sorry, not 2108. It's 2581A will be held for Thursday. And 2690 will be held for Thursday. So anybody that is here today, we won't be working on those three bills.
2581, you said?
Yes.
Okay. Okay,
what else? 2581A and 2690. Yes. I just
wanted to ask about 2581.
We're just waiting, I think, on 2581. Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, since members committee staff, on House Bill 2581, we had a request from Representative Piercy's staff to hold on that for a day. They are looking into a possible Attorney General's opinion on this subject from sometime in the past. I wanted to make sure that this bill addressed that opinion if it's appropriate.
Okay.
They're going to be ready to go on this tomorrow.
Okay, great. Thanks.
We had the amendment. Did we have the amendments ready on 2108?
Yes.
Okay, so we will.
I'd like the Senator Shannon.
Yeah. We caught all the ones that were not. I didn't want to keep anyone here longer than they needed to be.
Okay, I think that's the sum total of the announcements. So we're holding
case up amends. I don't know if John Bones is here.
Okay, we can. All right, we'll go with House Bill. The work section on House Bill 2146A.
You asked your question.
Yes, I got straight there. Actually, I'm sorry. If you're going to look at Dennis, it would be 2108.
Well, we'll do 2146A here, and it's and Barney here. Okay, let's go ahead. Barney, you should come up.
And 2690 is?
Yes.
2690 is, that's still tomorrow.
That's tomorrow.
And then we've done 2590. Okay.
Yeah.
And everything else.
Okay. Right.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Barney Spate, Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. It's being distributed to you as an overview memo that I'd like to walk through. There are amendments that are associated with this. Let me first talk about the bill as it comes to this committee and as it was passed by the House. 2146A amends the statutory functions of the Oregon Health Council. The Oregon Health Council is a nine-member body appointed by the governor and charged with identifying, analyzing, discussing through public forums, and developing recommendations related to critical health issues in Oregon. This bill was introduced at the request of our office, which serves as the professional administrative support to the council. And the purpose of the bill is to align the statutes that govern the council with current council activities. 2146A, prior to the -A2 amendments, which I'll get to in a moment, proposes to delete a statutory function, namely the development and adoption of a state health plan that has not been performed by the council for many, many years, in fact, since the days of federal health planning back in the early 80s. It also adds to the council's statutory function the preparation and submission of resolutions relating to health care reform to the governor and the legislative assembly. The health council supports this bill, and there is no fiscal impact related with it. The one change that was made on the House side was the addition of the resolutions being reported not only to the governor but to the Legislative Assembly. And as I mentioned in a colloquy with Senator Castillo last meeting, this has been supported because the work of the council feels that it does have a reporting relationship to the legislature and in its normal course of events tries to communicate with the Legislative Assembly on major policy issues. Now let me turn to the -A2 amendments that we are proposing to be amended into 2146A. These amendments were initially introduced on the House side as House Bill 2148. At the time of the hearing in the House, agreement did not exist among the interested parties on all aspects of the legislation. However, since that hearing, discussions have continued, and these amendments are the product of that effort. The -A2 amendments alter the statutes that govern the type of institutional data that's collected, analyzed, and reported by the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. That data is primarily hospital and proposed ambulatory surgical center data. What does the bill do? First, the existing role of the Health Council relating to statewide health care data is clarified to include that our office will report to the council on a biennial basis the findings, trends, and long-term implications arising from data gathered under this statute. In addition to collecting hospital inpatient discharge information, which I know we've collected for probably 10 or 15 years, long time, OHPPR is permitted to collect similar information relating to ambulatory surgery discharges. This expansion of data collection reflects the changes in medical technology over the last decade that have resulted in a significant shift from inpatient surgery to ambulatory or one-day surgical procedures. Ambulatory surgery data would also be collected from all institutions licensed to perform such procedures, namely general hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers that are licensed by the health division. Thirdly, OHCPR or our office may collect additional information available on the discharge abstract form necessary to the development and evaluation of statewide health policy. Fourth, while maintaining patient confidentiality, the amendments provide for the statistical linking of records relating to individuals admitted as hospital inpatients on multiple occasions during a calendar year. This change will increase the usefulness of the inpatient discharge data as a tool for monitoring clinical quality indicators such as readmissions within 30 days of discharge. Fifth, the amendments maintain the statutory provision that OHPPR may not publish information that allows for the identification of individual patients or licensed healthcare professionals. Sections 3, 5, 6, 8, 9, and 11 of the -A2 amendments relate to hospital financial data collected by my office. Section 11 eliminates five sections of the ORS relating to the collection and analysis of hospital budget, hospital rate, and hospital capital expenditure information. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've been collecting this information since probably the mid-70s, early 80s, and my determination or my suggestion to the committee that this information is really no longer relevant to a lot of the work that we do and would alleviate both the burden to the hospital industry and I think would bring our tasks more current with where, if you will, market forces are. We will continue to collect aggregate financial statement data and the survey of services information on an annual basis. However, the penalty for failure to provide annual utilization data is repealed. The current statute has a fairly heavy penalty in it for non-compliance of providing information on a survey. In fact, it's never been used, and I doubt that it ever would be used. That we can request the Medicaid administration to withhold 10% of payments, which is a fairly draconian hammer, and one that in our work with the industry over the years has never been necessary, so we thought it would be best to remove that. The amendments in Section 3, 5, and 9 delete references that are made obsolete as a result of repealing the statutes that I just mentioned in Section 7, or 11, excuse me, and otherwise archaic references. Section 6 does increase the civil penalties that may be levied on facilities that fail to provide required information. The current maximum is $100 per day, and it is raised to $500 per day. This is, from our perspective, merely trying to get the statute more current. This $100 a day civil penalty has been in effect for at least 10 years and perhaps longer than that.
Barney, who had charge over that before your policy committee was...
The civil penalties?
Yeah.
Our office, that statutory provision has been aligned with our office, and prior to the creation of our office and the merger in 1995, it was an entity within the health division that did this.
If you haven't had to use any of those penalties in the past, why have to increase them by $100?
Same question that was asked on the House side, Mr. Chair, and it's an excellent question. I think we're merely trying to align penalties in line with what is a reasonable deterrent for not complying, and for a major hospital institution, $100 a day is kind of like a $25 speeding ticket, I suppose. So it's merely, as I said on the House side, we've never used this.
Barney, that's a bad thing to use with me because...
The speeding ticket analogy?
Yeah. Huh? I'm having some real problems, and I'll just give you a brief on what it is. Right now, regardless of what all this fuel and garbage is going out about the state patrol, being shorthanded and everything, the fact is, about 20 of those people are dying on state and federal highways today than did in 1981. The speed limit's been raised. They have 200 and some less patrolmen out there. They're issuing thousands and thousands of less tickets. And the death rate's going down. Plus, traffic has increased 64% during that period of time. Cars are smaller and more dangerous than they were before. all of those things are happening that we've gone down 20 and they're crying that they need more officers. So what were they doing out there when they were writing thousands more tickets? And so the $25 ticket for me wasn't doing very much. And I don't know that it increases to 500 is going to make any more difference. It looks like by not writing the tickets, we're actually driving safer on the highways than we were before. So,
as a debate teacher once told me, metaphors are illustrative, yeah, not definitive. So,
I see a certain smiling face sitting behind me back there as I'm saying this, but I'm going to ask him to come up whether he wants to or not here in just a moment.
I think I know who you're referring to.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Section 4, again, is cleanup that deletes an archaic reference, and then the amendments at Section 7 permit our office to accept information relating to the utilization and cost of health care services from physicians, insurers, other third-party payers, or employers or purchasers. This change will allow our office to better serve parties interested in voluntary collaborative projects using merged health care data sets. Mr. Chair, those are the intent of the Dash 2 amendments, again, are to incorporate into 2146 the underlying concepts that were suggested in 2148. From my knowledge, our office has worked closely with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems to try to develop a consensus bill. They may have differences of opinion on the $100 to $500. But I think on the more technical aspects of data, this bill does reflect a consensus between the industry and our office.
How many times have you used the $100 fine?
To my knowledge, Mr. Chairman, never. I would stipulate on the record that the whole hospital inpatient data collection, the service utilization collection, and the financial data collection is done in a very collaborative manner between the association and its member institutions in our office. In fact, soon after I joined the office working with the association, we actually merged some of the data collection approaches because the American Hospital Association collects similar data. So we actually send the AHA data survey form out and ours out together, and we eliminated duplicative data requests. So we tried to streamline things, and it's that collaborative spirit that it is just not something new with me. It's happened for a decade or more. It's a very collaborative working relationship. So I would admit that the $100 or $500 is not a big deal. But
yes. Ed, would you come on up while you are up here and Barney here? Collaborating well enough, I won't have any firefighting to do.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ed Patterson, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals. And just a little background, Mr. Chair, when 2148 was over at the House, we were up against the deadline, and we were still in the process of trying to negotiate the terms of 2148, which basically had some of these provisions in it. And the chair over there decided that we just didn't have time to do it because of the deadline. So we continued to negotiate, as Barney indicated. And the Oregon Association of Hospitals is very supportive of the A2 amendments. In terms of the fine, which I think is what you really want me to respond to, we don't really object to the $500. As Barney indicated, it's not been used. One of the roles our association plays is making sure that all the members of our association do the reporting so that the data is current. And sometimes we have members of our association who do not believe data reporting is as high a priority as the leadership of our association does. So in a way, we could do without the $500 fine because we try to motivate our members to do the reporting anyway because it's very important data, and we are a central source for those collections. And as Barney indicated, we have worked collaboratively with his agency. And we believe it's in the best public interest to get this data in and have it current so that some analysis can be done, so marketing studies can be done, and more importantly, so utilization studies by his office can be done and contribute to good public policy.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Christine.
Thank you. I was just wondering on under number 6 here on the amendments listed as A, eliminating the 5 sections of ORS relating to the collection and analysis of hospital budget, service rate, and capital expenditure information. Just by having that continue to be reported, as opposed to collecting it in the aggregate financial statement data, does that mean that you have more detailed information? And if so, is that public information when that is provided to your to you? And by not having that detailed information, does that create a situation where that no longer would be public information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, what we're proposing to do is stop collecting a fairly massive amount of detailed information that relates to individual prices that hospitals might charge for services, and in lieu of that, continue to collect annual financial statement information. So you are correct that what we would stop doing would no longer be available either to us or to the public. It would be always available to the public to go directly to the hospital and ask for, you know, what are their charges for their daily room rate or for an x-ray or whatever. What we found, and I guess the reason that I suggested that this be eliminated, is that public billing rates in today's third-party insurance realm don't necessarily reflect what people pay. They reflect what the hospitals charge, but there are always a significant portion of their patients who are covered through managed care or other insurance agreements where they actually are reimbursed less than what their charges are. And so as a meaningful policy tool for us, it's been my suggestion that we stop doing that because it doesn't really help us understand what's happening in pricing, because that's more now incorporated into the whole insurance mechanism. This will allow us, and I think it's very important because institutional healthcare is at the core of healthcare, is to understand the financial viability of hospitals. And so the annual financial information that we would continue to collect and the service utilization will help us and the industry and all of you as we continue through kind of turbulent times.
Yes, thank you. But don't hospitals use the actual number of what they their hospital charges are to talk about how the reimbursements affect, you know, their overall collection or their overall loss that they take for providing services to folks on, you know, to folks that they get a lower reimbursement for? I think in presentations I've seen before that that figure of their actual charges versus what they get is very much used in presentations about whether or not they're losing money or you know how that figures into profits or whatever.
Correct.
For hospitals.
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, you are correct, and we would continue to have that type of information in an aggregate source off of the financial statement where we would not know, for example, is what does Hospital A charge, what's their public billing rate for a given service. But in the financial reporting that we receive, both the balance sheet and the operating statement, it would allow us and the industry to confirm for public policy purposes what are the write-offs associated with either charity care, with unfunded care, with discounts from charges based upon either public or private billing arrangements. So that would be known in the aggregate, and that's very useful for understanding the financial performance. But it's very difficult to take that aggregate and move back down into the line item service charges to make any understanding of what's the relationship. So we're really trying to focus on the data that in today's world is most relevant to policy and perhaps stop doing some things that were well-intentioned and I think helpful during the late 70s and early 80s when we were really, as a state, sitting in what I call the pre-regulatory mode. We were trying to understand what was going on in the hospital industry. And it's my considered opinion that some of this work is no longer relevant. But I assure you that we're interested in the same kinds of issues that you've articulated.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, if I might just comment on that. I have some disagreement with Barney because I think when this was originally imposed on hospitals, the data that was required to be reported, and if you'd see the form, you'd know that it was very selective, and I think overall it was probably irrelevant at the time, which is where I disagree with him. But in today's market, I agree 100%. In today's market, the information is very time-consuming for hospitals to collect. It's very arbitrary information. And then it has to be analyzed by his office, which costs more money. And by the time it goes through that process of reporting
analysis, it's outdated because it's not timely for making future decisions. So we would agree totally with the idea of removing that in today's marketplace.
Mr. Chair, could I offer a historical comment just to respond to my colleague's comment? Ten or 15 years ago, I wore his hat, and he was a hospital administrator. And this statute, as dumb as it was then and perhaps dumb as it is now, was a lot better than the hospital rate regulation.
The ultimate compliment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 446A and enter a work session on House Bill 446A. We have some amendments to adopt here potentially. Do I hear a motion to do that?
I'm still moving, Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan moves the A2 amendments, it's A2 amendments to House Bill 446. Is there any further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Now a motion to send House Bill 2146 as amended to the floor.
You're going to make a full salary.
Pardon?
You're going to make a full salary on that.
Yeah.
I so move.
Senator Duncan moves. Is that with due pass?
With the due pass recommendation. Senator, as amended.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2146 as amended with the E2 amendments to the Senate floor was a two-pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. So that carries for the bill. I would. Senator Castillo will carry the bill. After that, I close the work session on House Bill 2046A. We have Senator Shannon here. Go ahead with House Bill 2108.
You want to do
So I'll open the work session on House Bill 2108A.
You want me to talk about the amendment?
Certainly. You can do it there or go out front, whichever you care.
Oh, I'll do it right here. After our meeting on Monday, we met over here with Legislative Council. We came up with this amendment. I just want to say that I want to thank everybody for their help, and I don't think it has opposition. And where it says... if you're looking at it, the dash 3A3, the Oregon Board of Dentistry shall adopt rules authorizing a dentist licensed to practice dentistry in Oregon to administer local anesthesia for the purpose of tattooing lips by a licensed permanent color technician and tattoo artist. They realize that there is a definition that dentistry is the soft tissue around the mouth, which could be, and the lips, and that they are going to write rules so that retired dentists that have a license or have had can do this. And I support it, and I think they do too. And I think that there's no opposition.
That's John Bones to come from the Board of Dentistry. If you had anyone else that you wish to bring.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I'm Joanne Gongs, Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. I had nobody else who could make it today. The board can work with this. It will work. It recognizes, as Senator Shannon pointed out, what's happening, and the language for the rules can be developed fairly shortly.
Okay, now that was mentioned, retired dentists. Is there anything that would stop a regular dentist that was already licensed for doing the same thing? It wouldn't seem to me that it would matter whether it was a retired dentist.
The way I see it, it means I don't have to have a current practice. And there's a rule now that you have to have a current practice to practice. And so it carves out a niche. Is that right? You just fill your license. Right.
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon. We do have a little miscommunication about what retired means, and because the board, once a person retires their license, they are no longer licensed. That was the objection the board had to this yesterday, day before yesterday, which is so short. We were concerned that it be a licensed dentist. There is no requirement that a dentist own a practice in order to practice. I think the confusion has to do with a dental practice has to be owned by a dentist.
Okay.
But it's fine, and we understand where we were misunderstanding each other, and this works really well.
Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering, I know that when we talked about this the other day, you raised the issue of the oversight of the dentist, you know, because usually they're doing this with one of their own patients in their office, and there is oversight of in case there's any kind of reaction to the Novocaine or the anesthesia. So how are you going to work that out if this is not a patient of the dentist, but if somebody who's getting a service somewhere else, and how is that going to work?
Senator Fisher, Senator Castillo, we will have to work out those details, but certainly the board would want the dentist to be keeping records of what was being kept in there, what was being administered, and to probably stay on the premises long enough to make sure that there was no allergic reaction.
Because they usually have right away.
Do you see the sheriff, I can?
Yes.
Do you see the dentist who would be engaging in this having any problems with liability insurance, questioning whether or not they want to be cover this kind of activity if there isn't going to be the same kind of oversight as there is when people are in a patient of the dentist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, it's certainly a question, but it isn't anything that we've had an opportunity to address, and that would be between the dentist and their insurance carrier.
Yeah, okay.
Or the tattoo artist.
And the tattoo artist, and whatever the relationship.
And they don't require dentists to have liability insurance now to cover that. So we're a requirement. If you have your license, do you require dentists to have insurance?
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, and no, we do not require it.
Yeah. My guess is the dentist would be crazy.
That's right.
I'm listening to our dentist in the back of the room. Back it seems to me that there is a protection of the fact that says a dentist licensed to practice, right, and that dentist knows all the rules and regulations, and he or she is not going to step out of that bounds,
right,
because they're the ones taking the chance. So based on that, I'm not going to.
Okay, do we have a motion to accept the three amendments?
I move the dash three amendments.
Okay.
The House Bill 2108.
The dash eight three amendments have been moved for the House Bill 2108. Any objection? Further discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
And I move the House Bill 2108A. As amended to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Shannon moves House Bill 2108 as amended by the A3 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none? Will the clerk call the roll? Will you carry that?
I'll carry it, and I want to say again thank you to everybody.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
I'm going to vote no on this right now because I'm not totally comfortable with it. I may reserve the right to vote yes after I kind of look at this a little bit more on the floor.
I believe that Senator Shields here.
May I just say something before you vote? If you're uncomfortable, Senator Castillo, I can tell you OHSU is uncomfortable. the lobbyist canceled his dentist appointment to be here this morning. This is a minor part of a very big bill that OHSU needs and the dentistry needs, and I hope that they have a chance to explain the, you know, the purpose of the bill and all that. I hope that you can support it because it's not intended to be a bill killer.
Oh, that's right. This is an amendment.
Good bill.
Yeah, very good bill. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry that happened. I wish you would have kept it separate, but okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
this is a very big bill for HSU, and I wouldn't want to, excuse the pun, kiss it off for something that OHSU has agreed to.
But, Mr. Chair, there'll be no telltale marks.
You're so Presbyterian.
Can I see if you wish to vote at this time?
Aye.
Motion carries, and Senator Shannon will be the carrier of the bill. Work session on House Bill 2108A. Public hearing on House Bill 3031, and ask Jillian to go ahead on that after we have it introduced by Sam.
We had a minor accident.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Stambridge. House Bill 3031 contains my favorite word, notwithstanding, and it says that notwithstanding other provisions in the statute that prohibits the initiation of Oregon Board of Dentistry investigation of complaints against dentists and dental hygienists more than 5 years after conduct of the basis of the complaint, or if it is a case that involves fraud, deceit, misleading representation, more than 2 years from the date such conduct is discovered or should have been discovered. This is all on lines 2 through 8 on page 3 of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Try to make this at your convenience.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I did get a boot from the doctor yesterday. My foot is a lot more comfortable.
Good.
But I appreciate your putting these together. Again, I'm Joanne Bones, Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. This is an Oregon Dental Association bill which the board opposed when it was heard in the House because it significantly limits the board's discretion in investigating allegations made against licensees. And the board felt that it unnecessarily hampers the board's ability to protect the public. However, the board has now decided that it will not oppose this legislation. After reviewing our cases, there aren't that many incidents that come up that would prevent us from investigating the issues. Most of them come up sooner than 5 years. However, the board president, Chris Hudson, who's our consumer member, did ask me to point out to you for the record that she feels, and many of the board members feel, that the public should be equally protected by all licensing boards, and this bill will make the Board of Dentistry the only agency that has a limitation on its investigatory powers in this respect. Thank you.
Yes, you said that it was you opposed in the House.
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, yes, we did.
But now you're still short. I was reading something.
That's right. Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, the bill initially introduced was for a 2-year statute of limitations. When the board discussed this in their board meeting, their decision was that they wanted, if they had the choice, no statute of limitations at all. But after it was amended and passed through the House, the board did decide that it could live with the 5-year limitation with the 2-year extension for fraud, deceit,
okay,
and misrepresentation. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Senator Shields.
Is that 2-year extension and all of this from the initiation of, sometimes what's significant is where you start the clock.
Right. Senator Fisher, Senator Shields, it's my understanding that it's 2 years from the date of discovery in addition to the 5 years where the cases of fraud, deceit, or misleading misrepresentation is discovered or should have been discovered with the exercise of reasonable care.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Christine.
I also see here that this bill will make the Board of Dentistry the only health licensing board with a restriction on the age of issues which it will be able to investigate. And I think that raises a very good point here. we're not seeing any other licensing board coming forward with this. I'm wondering why this restriction should be done for the Board of Dentistry.
We will have the representatives from the Dental Association here testify, I believe. Come on up forward, Jane. Go ahead and give your testimony here to us. I didn't mean to exclude you.
Quite right.
Follow through. He'll be getting all the witnesses up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers. I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and we requested the bill. We also requested the amendment that moved it from 2 years to five. Part of, I think one of, to answer some of the questions about the Board of Dentistry would be the only one. The Board of Dentistry had a task force that operated. Maybe the Board of Dentistry was a little advanced, actually, in looking at the whole discipline process of discipline and handling complaints. It did involve some of the folks from the Oregon Dental Association and some other people. And one of the task force's recommendations, although I will clarify that the board does not support it, but one of their recommendations was that there should be some sort of limitation on old complaints or complaints that go back a long time. And I don't think that the language that's included in the bill is particularly restrictive. It's 5 years from probably would be the date of treatment. It doesn't include any kind of, if somebody has a criminal charge, like sexual misconduct or something like that, that certainly is not covered by this statute. That would be covered by criminal law statutes. The dentist wanted some kind of certainty because they're holding on to records, and I'm sure many of you, when you go to your dentist's office, see the wall full of records that they're pulling your case from, and at some point, they need to be able to destroy records. Now, the dentist who holds on to his records longer than 7 years, he or she, is actually at somewhat of a disadvantage because at that point, if the board gets a complaint that's 8 years old or 8 years from the last date of treatment, and the dentist just happens to have the records, the dentist is in the unfair advantage of having maintained records instead of tossing them so the board can then proceed with an investigation of some rather old material. The statute, or this amendment, is actually based on a statute about how long a person has to file a malpractice complaint against a professional. It's pretty much the same language, except we've changed it from an action to an investigation of a complaint. So, yes, the board is going to be probably the only regulatory board that has such a statute, but I guess we'd argue that maybe it's time to consider some of these statutes, and the Oregon Dental Association, we just try to write or ask for legislation that affects our board because we're not in a position to argue for other boards or what that might be, but that's our view of it. We hope that you can support the bill and pass it out to the floor. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Okay. Yes, Senator Christine.
I'd like to ask the representative of the Board of Dentistry, what role do old records, or just records in general, whatever their date, play in your efforts to monitor dentists or investigate complaints? Are they important to the work, to doing that work? Are they hardly ever used? What kind of
problems are they facing? Senator Fisher, Senator Castillo, the patient records that the dentist keeps are critical to the board being able to look at issues that involve the patient's dental care. There might be instances where a patient complains to us that they shifted dentists, for instance, after many years of care by one dentist, go to another dentist, the new dentist says, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe the condition of your mouth, and that this and this and this and this are wrong." And the patient complains to us that their previous dentist hadn't provided them with adequate care in the past. We ask for those records if they still exist. Our requirements are that the dentists keep records for 7 years after the last date of entry. And we will go back through those records to see what they show, where there are x-rays. Maybe the dentist missed something, did not diagnose something, maybe didn't treat something that should have been treated more promptly.
Then, Mr. Chair,
yes, thank you.
You just said 7 years after the last date of entry. I'm trying to make that sentence make sense to me.
Senator Fisher, Senator Shields.
Are you saying a starting point?
From the last date of entry.
Back 7. What if the last date of entry is already 3 years back? Or something? I don't understand.
Senator Fisher, Senator Shields, the way I understand it, I've been going to the same dentist for 15 years. If I stop seeing him today, he can destroy those records 7 years from now.
Oh,
okay.
Any questions?
If, yes. If I could add to that, the case where a person goes to a new dentist and the new dentist says, you know, your old dentist did not do a good job here, and the patient decides to file a complaint. It's hard to imagine that somebody would be out 5 years from their last dental visit to going to a new dentist. I mean, it's just not that common an occurrence. I think the board on the other side was in the House was talking about most of the complaints about unacceptable patient care come up rather quickly.
Right. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3031A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3031A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill. I guess I'll bang the gavel here. Senator Duncan moves it. Well, this was a work session, wasn't it? We went in the public hearing. Where were we?
That was public hearing.
Okay, well, I'm going to start over again here. I'm going to close the public hearing or whatever else it was. We're doing an open conversation on House Bill 3031A. And go ahead, Senator.
I move House Bill 3031A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 3031A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Steele.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to vote no on this bill. I just see it as a consumer protection issue. We just heard the representative from the Board of Dentistry say that the records are critical to investigating the quality of dental care, and why we would want to limit the amount of records available for those investigations. I think consumers would be very concerned about that, and I just can't support this.
Well, I might indicate that it passed the House Committee with a complete acceptance, and it was 54-0 on the House floor, so
in this sense, the zeros are right, but then,
yeah. No. But anyway, we will certainly not try to deny you your dead and hearing. But hearing no further objections, we'll let clerk call the roll.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Jones?
Aye.
Senator
Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher? Aye. Motion carries. Senator Duncan, you want to carry that?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Duncan will be the carrier. And so the work session on House Bill 3031A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2703.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2703 allows the Fiscal Service Licensing Board to use disciplinary action by another state as grounds for sanction, and it also increases the maximum civil penalty for disciplinary actions from $1,000 to $5,000. Also allows the board to sanction persons practicing physical therapy without a license. We included a statute that is the added grounds for discipline, and that is or at 688.020, the license required to practice physical therapy.
Okay. We don't even have anybody here to talk about it. So, I don't have any answers to any questions you might ask here today. So.
I'm not going to ask any.
Senator Duncan, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2703A and open a work session on House Bill 2703A.
Move House Bill 703 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Oh, no, we're not going to do that. Yeah, we're going to do it another way.
Okay.
Hearing no further discussion or any objections to House Bill 2703A, will the clerk call a roll?
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Kennedy?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. We have three. I'll carry it. Get it on its way. And now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3093.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3093 authorizes physician's assistance in an emergency dispense drugs prepared or prepackaged by a manufacturing drug outlet or a wholesale drug outlet. This information is all on page 2 of the bill in two lines, lines 5 and 6.
We have Jeff Watkins. Go ahead, Jeff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Watkins. I'm with the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. And just briefly, as you know, a physician assistant is a healthcare professional who provides physician services under the supervision of a physician. And PAs and physicians work as a team to provide affordable, quality healthcare. And we, kind of our specialty is in medically underserved and disadvantaged areas. This bill is really kind of a small bill. As I indicated, we work a lot in nonprofit clinics and places like that where the traditional public doesn't usually go. And it's common to have drugs there that have been sent in bulk from the manufacturer, so they're like in a big box or prepackaged or something like that. And it's as a part of the job requirement, it is to dispense some of those drugs like antibiotics, antihistamines, things like that. But it appeared that we've learned that in our little statute, there's a section that says that we can only dispense drugs that have been prepackaged by a licensed pharmacist. Yeah. And so what the change does is it basically allows us to dispense from packages that have been prepackaged by someone other than a licensed pharmacist that has been authorized by the Board of Pharmacy. And I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. We had some concerns with the Pharmacy Association. We took care of those on the House side, and this is a good bill and should pass.
See anyone further wishing to testify on this? We have no one listed. Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3093A and open a work session on House Bill 3093A. Yes, Senator Shields.
I'd move 3093A to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves House Bill 3093A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator
Kennedy?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye. Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will be the carrier. Close the, thank you, Jeff, for coming.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 3093A, and do you have others than...
We have just
got
one left.
Is Representative Wells the only one that wishes to speak to that, or do you have others?
Sure.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3603, and if there's anyone wishing here to testify, they can come forward on this. We have sent for Representative Wells. If no one else wishes to discuss this, I will go into recess here momentarily.
Oh, I'm going to stay to vote on it, but this is pretty easy. Yeah,
we can vote it out and then let them talk.
Let them talk on this. And we can change our minds.
Is he in support of it?
Yeah. be sponsored.
Okay. We have a letter here from Peter Anderson, Ph.D., clinical chemist, and yes, he is in opposition to the bill.
Here's a simple answer with the administrative rule.
So, what was the verdict on Rick Cindy Wells? They had trouble finding him?
Yeah, there's, he's in the House Transportation, I think.
All right. So. Okay. We'll give him a minute and a half to walk the distance.
Well, I hope you'll maybe go for 2 minutes.
All right.
Senator?
Yes, Senator.
So, did you work every other one on our list?
Yes, we have a couple that were postponed over because of amendments on it.
Okay, which two are they?
2185A and
2581?
81.
Uh-huh.
And 2690.
And 2690?
I wonder if come forward to Representative Wells. This could be given to Representative Wells so he can respond to this.
Yes, Representative Wells, we have a letter here and at least a little opposition to this bill from a clinical chemist. Have you seen that letter, Dr. Ph.D., Dr. Peter H. Anderson?
Probably.
Chair, Tory Wells, sponsor of the bill. No, I haven't, Mr. Chair.
Give him a copy.
He's got, okay.
Mr. Chair, I brought along Representative Lehman. Representative Lehman carried the bill on the floor. And a little background on this issue. David McCordy is a constituent of mine. He is a doctor, out at the state hospital, and test was taken, a substance abuse test was taken, and through that they found some ethanol in his blood. It was a blood test for drinking. They found some alcohol in his blood, and he was fired. And then he went back and asked for a copy of the test, and they wouldn't give him a copy of it. And he asked if he could have a split sample, and they said they would not give that. They had not kept that, and he had no way. It actually, this thing ended up in court to finally get a copy of the test results. And so he brought this bill here as kind of a protective device, especially when it deals with, because this bill really deals with when employment is involved, and not to help him, he's retired now, but to help other people dealing with substance abuse. So Representative Lehman.
Yes, Senator Brunson. Was he reinstated with his job?
No.
But the court... Did the court rule
he finally got a copy of the test, but it was upheld that he lost his job. He had 0.04 alcohol in his blood, and they have a zero tolerance out there. According to this test, they said he had 0.04. And he never did get his job back. He consequently is retired. Representative Lehman, then he put the bill together. We did quite a bit of research down in legislative council to come up with the right statute to deal with this issue, because this whole chapter here deals with tests taken for health reasons, and there really didn't seem to be much there dealing with substance abuse. And this chapter 438, what we're looking at here. So I had legislative counsel do some research, and then they finally came back and said, no, this is the only place we deal really with substance abuse tests. And so this is the section we need to amend to deal with this issue. And then in the original bill, You'll see on page 2, line 34, the word illegal was taken out. Well, that had concern then with the pharmacies. And the pharmacists came in. Yeah, there's a bill.
I have it.
I have copies of the original bill.
Original bill, the word illegal was taken out. So then, on that, on page 2, line 34, the Pharmacy Association then came in, and they were concerned about that language there, and so they offered an amendment to change that. You'll see then in the, let's see, what do we have here? The, I think there's some draft. In A and Gross, okay, I don't have the amendments. In the A and Gross, then in page 2, we took out that whole line and they put in there on line 39 a further definition of substance abuse. That amendment came from the pharmacy people and John Brownman and those people that represent that group. And then the health department came in and was concerned about the language on page 4 dealing with, because they regulate, the health division regulates labs who do the substance abuse testing on site. And they offered then that amendment that's on line 17 on page 4, then that was all new language that was part of that amendment, and that was satisfied their concern. So there was quite a bit of work done on this bill by pharmacy, drug people, as well as the health division who represent the labs. And then Representative Lehman carried the bill on the floor, and he worked, I'll let him explain his interest in this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Lehman, State Representative from District 47. I must say I'm here because I missed all this stuff when I came through committee, and only when I'm getting ready to prepare the bill and carry the bill on the floor do I discover something that causes me some concern, and that is the requirement that you split the sample, and it mirrors what's in this letter from the clinical chemist, and that is, and I'll give you an example. Last session, I got a bill passed that allows the drug abuse self-test. It's a cup that you tip over and test, and you get immediate results. We got that admitted, but in order for you to use that positive test to not employ somebody, which is what my company uses it for, you have to send it to a lab for confirmatory testing. In other words, if it's negative, you just go from there and you hire the person. If it's positive, you've got to send it to a real lab to be tested. If I read this language, what it's now going to require us to do, everybody that comes in for a test, we're going to have to do two cups. Getting past the issue of what you're dealing with are specimens, and you simply don't want to have that many cups of urine floating around officers that you're testing in, it just creates all these problems of documenting and taking care of them. Frankly, I think you could take, and I read that to say that we have to now do it with the company, I think you could take that language out of there. I think Representative Wells' original intent is fine. I mean, I think everybody ought to have a right to their test results from the laboratory. But for us to split them, take two samples, and then simply dispose of them if they're negative, which is what we're going to do, doesn't make any sense. If they're positive and we send them on the lab for confirmatory testing, then the lab ought to split them if that's going to be the requirement. But I think this goes far beyond that, and only in reading it on the floor did I discover that it's overbroad in that regard. In all honesty, I think you could delete all of Section 9, accomplish Representative Wells' goals, limit the double collection, and be far forward. Drug testing is becoming more and more prevalent, whether it be in our schools or in an employment place, and you know, this is going to add one more burden. Essentially, every school is going to have to collect two samples now if they do a self-test at school. And I think that's probably overburdensome. And I don't know Representative Wilson, but I think you could take out Section 9 unless that creates real problems in the health division. I think you solve his problems and mine and many of Dr. Anderson's.
Senator?
Yes.
I have a question.
Senator Shannon.
And I would like you to seriously consider it. But my husband's in the military. He's a, and every time he's tested randomly, he goes directly to a lab and gets his own test. And I just think what where you work as an employer, right? You must be in management. Would it be too burdensome for employers that do drug testing to have a sign where the employees see it, that for your own protection, just your own, something to that effect? Because knowledge is power. Like if the one, the constituent or the man that Representative Burroughs worked with, if he had just gone and got his own, there wouldn't be all this. And it's a little bit the responsibility of the person who wants to keep the job or get the job. And instead of all of these, all we do is post your right, you know, or post a good advice.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shannon, you know, the interesting thing is that we do, you know, probably upwards of 50 to 100 tests per month. We're still talking one or two positives a month, if that many. We're down around the 2% number, so it's very rare that we are getting a positive test that we're sending on for confirmatory testing. The nice thing about the self-test is you know right away that you've got a positive on the self-test, and you can then decide to the individual, you know, if you think there's something wrong here, you ought to go get your own test or take another sample someplace else and test it. Surprisingly, or not so surprisingly, I guess most people say, oh, no, that's okay. I mean, they're not usually too surprised that they have a positive test when it comes out. Well, I just wonder why they're in.
Well,
taking the test.
And they have access to it. Excuse me. They have, you show them or whatever. After I spoke, I got to thinking about why wouldn't they have access to your own urine specimen test? That's really wild.
Representative Lynn, what company do you work for?
Company called Cardinal Services. It's employee leasing, temporary employee services.
Yeah, we have a division over in Roseburg.
Yes, they do have an office in Roseburg. Thank you for the advertisement, Senator.
You know, this bill was in good shape until they brought this lawyer along. Help
him out. Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, the farmer and the lawyer have done a lot of good work together, and this is just another example of that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I realize this has been a kind of a tough issue. I am open to any suggestions, and Representative Lehman will work out there in the field in this area. And the split sample and keeping that sample stored and all this sort of thing seems to be problem issue.
Let me ask you guys a question, because it says if the test will be our denial or deprivation of employment or any benefit, do you have to split any one of them and keep it if it isn't positive?
Senator Fisher, looking at this, yes. The way I read this now, I think when they come in, we have to take two samples right away. And then if we're negative, we throw away both samples. I don't see here, you know, I think that's the requirement of the statute, which, as I've indicated, I think is probably overbroad.
So if you're throwing away two samples, or if you're on the negative, you don't have to keep them if they show negative.
Right.
So that's no problem.
That is not a problem.
How do they know that you didn't take a split sample? If you test one and it's positive, pour it into another jar and you got a split sample.
Mr. Chairman, my guess is what's going to happen is on the negative, it's never going to be a problem. The first positive sample that we send into the lab and is confirmed and comes back, and they're going to say, I only gave you one sample, I know that, you violated the law, you know, yakety yakety yakety, we got a problem. I mean, obviously the negative will probably never crop up, but it will be the positive sample.
It doesn't say they have to give you two samples, does it? They just have to have a split. Is there anything in there that limits the employer from splitting the sample?
Mr. Chairman, again, you know, taking my legal expertise to the full limits of common sense, I would say that probably what's going to happen is that you get into one of these litigations and somebody's going to come in and say, he's going to, you know, take a deposition of all our employees, and they're going to say, no, we didn't ever split the negatives. Now, I think we're out of sync with the statute if we don't separate the samples all the time. I think you're probably right. Common sense says it really isn't going to be a problem. You simply separate them when you have a positive test and go forward. But I am concerned that we would be out of sync with the statute.
Well, I wish this was sworn testimony. I'd love to publish your explanation. I don't think I've ever heard an attorney admit that about taking something hearing.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we take out Section 9 and eliminate, of course, the whole issue of splitting the sample, I don't know what kind of a bill we have left.
What if we just did it on anyone that showed positive, that sample would have to be split and sent to the laboratory. Would that answer the question?
Absolutely. I have no problem with that, Senator. And if you say that if the original self-test is positive, then it must be split into two samples, that's not a problem at all.
Okay.
I think that is a good answer, because right now it just says if a positive test will result for employment, then you would do it for everyone. And most all these do result in employment issues, so you are, in a case sense, doing it for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And this,
I don't know why it wasn't written that
this
way.
This didn't have anything to do with the pharmacy issue when it did it.
No.
Well, who all are we dealing with that would be?
The health division was the one who wrote all of this language on line 17 through there. And
could you possibly get with the health division?
Their issue had to do with the fact that they, this language here on line 24, the laboratory choice must be a laboratory license under ORS 430.
Yeah.
They're the ones who regulate the laboratories. That's the only thing they were concerned about.
Okay, so it's just basically amongst yourselves here what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
I have a potential meeting published Friday. If we could get this amendment out, I can schedule this bill Friday and get it on out of here. And it may be the only thing that we'd have to meet for. Yes, do you have some comments? Oh, finding some up, I apologize for not recognizing you. It's also scheduled for tomorrow, but I can't get an amendment back in time to probably, unless you could do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Could you publish that before so we could do this by 9:45?
It's on the agenda.
Is it 9:30 or 9:45?
Oh, it's on the agenda, so if we can get a memo, we're okay. We could do this tomorrow.
Okay, Chairman Fisher, for the record, I am Audrey Horton, and I am the Program Manager of Laboratory Licensing, and we are the entities that regulate clinical laboratory testing and substance of abuse testing in Oregon. And it is our office that drafted the 9 amendments on here, and the purpose that we did that for was simply because when we met with Representative Wells, it was clear that what was intended was not how the bill was written. We did not take a position on whether this was, in fact, something that should be passed, because we felt that was not an issue that was something the Health Division should make that decision on. What we were concerned about, whether this was something that did as it, what it was intended, and didn't have a conflict with our law. And there were originally some conflicts with other aspects of our law, and so that was what we had addressed. Now, we don't take a particular position about whether you should split samples or not, but the concern would be there are more than one kind of method for doing substance abuse testing. And if you collect only one specimen and you're using some sort of dipstick or something where you now dip it into a urine, you have now contaminated that urine and could potentially, in the eyes of some individuals, have adulterated that sample, so it would now not necessarily be a good sample for other tests. Now, there are ways we can probably get around that, but in part of the arena where substance abuse testing is done, we have no oversight other than to write some rules for standards which they have to comply to, and we don't walk through the door of those facilities. And that would be a lot of the employee situations where the employer does the test on the employee or potential employee. But I do think there's probably a way we can hammer some language out that would meet the requirement.
All right. Well, I tell you what.
That's what you want to do?
I guess it doesn't seem to me that it's such a great big deal of doing the 2 samples if you can throw away the negative. As long as you're certain that you can do that here, you don't have to keep the 2 samples around, as you're saying, for long periods of time. So if you can't do something that's pretty positive, then you won't be messing up your opportunity to pursue a positive sample.
The only thing I'd say is I don't know if there's a big problem, but it does get to be an issue. One, each of those little cups is about $20 to do the test. So we start, you know.
Why do you have to do that into that particular cup? Can you not just take a sample like you normally take samples in a cheap bottle and transfer it yourself into that?
Senator, that is a solution to use two separate samples from two different cups, one the test cup and one the non-test cup. And again, I just say it's not a big problem, but we add one more layer of regulation. We've now got to clearly identify both samples from the same person, and it does compound the problems within our offices. And again, you're handling now two samples a urine rather than one.
Briefly, for those of us that are not totally medical lab oriented, why do you have to have a split sample?
The issues generally are, as I indicated, that there are different ways of doing tests. Now, some of the methods, and I believe the methods that are commonly used, the test is actually performed, there are some cases where it's actually performed in the cup. The original cup that you collected in and is identified and has the chain of evidence attached with it also contains maybe some temperature control things where the specimen needs to go into so you can tell if that specimen was recently voided and so that it wasn't something that somebody came with in a pocket or something. And some of the methods then have, as I say, have objects that are then immersed into the urine specimen. In some cases, it's the original urine specimen. And once you do that, if you open a package, the potential is there for someone to have contaminated the object that goes into the cup and adulterate it so that you can get a positive specimen. And so it makes it difficult for those things to be upheld in a court of law should they be challenged.
Well, you have that same thing in a laboratory. Anybody working in a laboratory that takes that specimen could dump something in it. I mean, there's no guarantee in any of this that I see that you've got something that...
That is correct. The split sample is something that is done traditionally in the Department of Transportation. The federal government requires that employees that work for the Department of Transportation, pilots who fly planes, and all of those do drug testing. And the split sample is something that was worked out by the Department of Transportation and is published in the Federal Register and is the gold standard for this kind of event.
Yes. Oh, I guess if I'm hearing it right, the reason that it's split is they might want to use two tests.
That, Senator Duncan, Chair Fisher, that is correct. That sometimes the initial screen is simply a screening test and it can give false positives as well as false negatives. So in instances then what they do is they do a confirmatory test by another scientific method to confirm the presence of the drug.
The deal now where you've been sending just your positive test in, you don't have anything but what you had in that first cup. How you send that in the lab?
Mr. Chairman, exactly the point that, you know, we're already sending the positive test in for confirmatory testing. If we're botching it up and contaminating, we're already doing it when it goes in.
Yeah.
So splitting it into two contaminated samples really doesn't gain much.
Double botch.
The point is that, you know, we're sending it in for confirmatory testing already.
Yeah, he's telling me that those things show contamination or possibility of contamination. Well, but apparently that's not been ruled out by the court.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Why can't, I want to take us back to an earlier question. Why can't we just have what the clinical chemist suggests, just do it by rule? I don't understand. I mean, his suggestion is the last paragraph of the letter that you've written.
Mm-hmm. If you read this.
I mean, is the bill really needed? Is this really necessary?
Well, if we need an amendment, I won't be working it today. That's what we've got to decide. We decide to work it. We can work it. We don't have a regulation thing up here right away. See, I can't see why if you've got a split sample and they're sending this in to the lab, I can't see why, you know, there's an objection now to what the courts are accepting, what's going on with these pre-tests that are being sent in and analyzed and that's being accepted. I don't see why a split test is necessary to
Mr. Chairman, the second language in there is exactly what I would have, you know, the language in your last paragraph is, I think, exactly on the money. Once our tests go to a toxicology lab for testing, you know, I don't have any complaints there that they can be split, they can be tested twice, the results released, because that's really, well, when we deny employment, that's what we're going on. It's the confirmatory testing. It's not our initial test. And I think, again, I think it's up to us, and we can do it by rule if necessary, to make certain that we get an uncontaminated sample to the laboratory. And I will assure you that everybody that's doing these self-tests is going to make sure they get an uncontaminated sample to the laboratory. I believe they're doing that now. And I would even address that by rule probably.
The problem is we're getting the rule done after we get out of here.
Senator Fisher and committee members, we would be glad to work with them and to draft some language in the rule that would be acceptable if that would be the will of the committee.
Well, I always prefer things by rule.
Well, I don't have a problem with rule either, but I'm not going to sit here and kill a bill without some pretty thorough assurance that this is going to get worked out and satisfactory to the pharmacy needs and one thing and another here too that might not be necessarily addressed in this.
Mr. Chair, I think
Senator Shields.
I'm only suggesting that as one of the possibilities for Representative Wells to consider. I'm looking to you, sir, for action.
I think that's the way we need to go. I think we're having too many problems here with that language in 9. And I'm questioning if we take that whole section out. We still have this definition here. Substance abuse means ethanol and controlled substances. And the doctor here, he feels that's, of course, unprecedented. Of course, I was shocked originally when my constituents came to me and they took a blood test for alcohol.
Did they say anything? I'm not medical. How did this ethanol get in there? Somebody drinking?
I saw a copy of the test and it said ethanol. And I says, they used a blood test? He says, yeah. And that was on the basis they fired him.
Well, what's the difference between if you're high on ethanol or high on methanol or
well, mostly
whatever other kind of wood alcohol? It sounds like he was trying to drink some cheap booze.
I don't know, how else would they get
that in the system? I mean, we're not born with ethanol in our veins, are we?
I don't know. What is your response to this language to me? What have we done with that language? Because we played around with that quite a bit, too.
Yeah, Chairman Fisher and committee members, I think if we went back to the original intent and the original definition of substance abuse when this law was written over 10 years ago, that it had language that would in fact have included alcohol in it. 2 years ago, when we made a modification of the substance abuse definition, we were trying to clear up some problems with some wording where it talked about substances which had mood-altering effects, and in the courts had been pulling in individuals who had been having difficulty with things like caffeine and other things that had been brought up. So we inserted the word illegal. When we in fact did that, where alcohol was originally included in the bill, then it was excluded because it is not an illegal drug. So that what we were doing was trying to put back in what we believe was the original intent of the substance abuse law.
Okay. Mr. Chair, clarify what you said. You like this definition here?
Yes.
Well, what I'm going to do, we're doing on the Senate floor. So what I'm going to do, we've got this bill published for tomorrow. If we have to do something by Friday, would either Representative Lehman or Representative Wells let our committee administrator, Mr. Stembridge, know that you aren't able to get something around until, so we need to go ahead and schedule this for Friday. If you want to pull 9 out and
I'd recommend, if the Health Division likes this new language we have here on page 2, and we're providing the results, just go with that not right there.
Okay, well, what about if you want to leave the last portion in there about the laboratory of choice must be a laboratory? And just
we take out all of section 9.
to take out the entire section 9.
Chairman Fisher, as it stands now, confirmatory testing can only be done in a licensed clinical laboratory.
So if you take out part of 9, all of 9 should go.
Yeah.
Okay, well,
are you happy with that?
We have this scheduled for tomorrow, so if you could let us know so that we have at least 24 hours notice.
I think that's what we'd like to do.
I think that's a great solution. I think it covers what Representative Wells wants and the rights and what you love.
Do you want to take care of that then with LC so that we have the amendment? They should be able to get that out tomorrow. That shouldn't be a big...
Thank you, sir. One of the two of us will take care of that.
Ms. Denbridge, so please take care of that.
Okay,
now, if you want to go ahead and be on the agenda tomorrow, then when it comes?
No, I have my own committee in the morning.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't want to deny anybody an opportunity there.
Just go ahead and take out that section 9.
All right. Okay. We will do that. Thank you so much for coming, and we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3603 and... close station Health and Human Services.
We want any mention of administrative rules.